Ukrainian forces continue their push into Kursk.
Photos from the area show that the armed forces of Ukraine captured more than 40 Russian prisoners of war at the Sudzha checkpoint, and there is heavy damage to buildings there.
Plus, Israelis are coming to grips with Yahya Sinwar as the political leader of Hamas.
This is the first time that all the power within Hamas is in the hands of one person, and it happens to be the one person who is maybe the most extreme person within Hamas.
And later, Nicolas Maduro lashes out at social media companies and a look at gender equality in Africa. Today is August 9th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukrainian forces have been making inroads into the southwestern Russian Kursk region. They say it's to create a buffer zone to prevent Moscow from using the area to stage and launch attacks against Ukraine. Anna Chernikova has the latest from Kyiv.
All eyes are on the Kursk region in Russia as Ukrainian forces continue to advance deep into the Russian territory. Some Russian sources report that Ukrainian forces have taken control of two more settlements in the region. According to Forbes, Ukraine deployed at least three brigades, its toughest and fastest, each with up to 2,000 troops. According to various reports from Russian and Ukrainian mill bloggers, allegedly Ukrainian forces have breached two lines of Russian defense. Institute for the Study of War confirms that Ukrainian troops have already advanced at least 10 kilometers deep into Russian territory. Meanwhile, Estonian intelligence reports that based on open data, Ukrainian troops had advanced about 15 kilometers from the border into Kursk region. Photos from the area show that the armed forces of Ukraine captured more than 40 Russian prisoners of war at the Sudzha checkpoint, and there is heavy damage to buildings there. As Washington Post reports, an advisor to President Volodymyr Zelensky on the condition of anonymity confirmed the Ukrainian military activity inside Russia and said Ukrainian forces has seized about 100 square kilometers. The Ukrainian operation in the Kursk region of Russia does not violate the U.S. policy regarding the use of weapons provided to Kyiv. This according to deputy spokesperson of the U.S. Defense Department, Sabrina Singh.
They are taking actions to protect themselves from attacks that are coming from a region that are within the U.S. policy of where they can operate, our weapons, our systems, our capabilities.
The Pentagon said that Ukraine's advance in the Kursk region is consistent with U.S. policy.
As they see attacks coming across the border, they have to be able to have the capabilities to respond. And so you're seeing some of these cross-border counterfire measures.
Also, the U.S. Department of Defense emphasized that Washington is not concerned about a possible escalation by the Russian Federation. The Ukrainian authorities and the military have not directly commented on the events in the Kursk region of Russia, where, according to the local authorities and the mass media, the offensive of Ukrainian forces continues for the fourth day. However, the Ukrainian military confirmed that another Russian helicopter was taken down by a Ukrainian drone in the Kursk region. In his evening address, President Zelensky said he had three detailed reports in a day from the commander-in-chief Oleksandr Syrsky.
Сьогодні було вже три доповіді головкома Сирського. Доповіді результативні, саме такі.
He said there were productive reports, exactly the kind our country needs now. However, he did not provide any further details. Meanwhile, the general staff of the armed forces of Ukraine confirmed the attack on the Russian airfield in Lipetsk in western Russia. According to preliminary data, warehouses with guided aerial bombs and a number of other objects near the airport were hit during the attack. Heavy fire and detonation were reported. Also, the general staff reported that it is Su-34, Su-35 and MiG-31 aircraft of the Russian Air Space Forces were based there. The actual damage is still unclear. The regional administration of the Ministry of Emergency Situation of the Russian Federation also reported about the fire at the military airfield. The governor of the region said that Lipetsk suffered a massive drone attack. He added that the energy facility was also damaged and reported 6 victims. According to Russian Ministry of Defense, 19 drones were allegedly shot down over the Lipetsk region. Meanwhile, Russian troops launched an airstrike using Kh-38 missile on the town of Konstantinivka in the Donetsk region. The grocery store and a post office were hit directly. Local authorities confirmed at least 14 victims, including a child, and at least 43 people were wounded. President Zelensky reported that the rescue operation is ongoing and there are still people remaining under the rubble. Anna Chernikova, VOA News.
And now to the Middle East, where Israelis are concerned about the appointment of Yahya Sinwar as the leader of Hamas. Sinwar spent more than 20 years in an Israeli jail and is seen as the mastermind of the October 7th attacks. He's believed to be in a Gaza tunnel, with some of the hostages being held as human shields. Israeli analysts say his appointment could make it harder to reach a ceasefire deal. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Since the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israeli civilians, Israel has worked to assassinate all of Hamas's leaders. One who has managed to avoid getting killed is Yahya Sinwar, the man who is now leading the group. He is believed to be hiding underground in a tunnel in Gaza, using Israeli hostages as human shields. Gershon Baskin spent years indirectly negotiating with Sinwar for the release of a kidnapped Israeli soldier.
Today, Yahya Sinwar runs the political bureau and the military wing of Hamas. This is the first time that all the power within Hamas is in the hands of one person, and it happens to be the one person who is maybe the most extreme person within Hamas.
Baskin doesn't expect any major changes in Hamas's negotiating position for a ceasefire that could end the war in Gaza and free the remaining hostages. He says Sinwar is known as an extremist.
He is, without question, very extreme, very religious, has a distorted view of what Islam is, believes that the most important commandment in his version of Islam is to be a martyr for Palestine.
Israel sentenced Sinwar to life imprisonment in 1989 for masterminding an attack that killed 2 Israeli soldiers and for killing 4 Palestinian collaborators. He spent more than 20 years in Israeli jails, speaks Hebrew fluently, and sees himself as an expert on Israel. He was one of more than 1,000 Hamas prisoners released in 2011 in exchange for kidnapped Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Israeli officials say they are determined to kill Sinwar as they have other Hamas leaders involved in the October 7th attacks that triggered this war. Israeli Army Chief Herzl Halevi says Sinwar's rise as leader of Hamas gives Israel an even greater motive to find him. He says Israel will work to kill Hamas's leaders as quickly as the group replaces them. On the streets of Gaza, opinion is divided on whether Sinwar's appointment would bring both sides closer to a deal to end 10 months of war. Gaza resident Bashir Karkaz thinks Sinwar's appointment will make the war in Gaza drag on longer because Israelis want someone who is less extremist. But others say Sinwar's naming could make it easier to make a deal with Israel. Another Gaza resident, Hani Alkano, says he hopes it will speed up the end of the war because Sinwar lives inside the Gaza Strip and, Alkano believes, is more familiar with the negotiations. After 10 months of war, civilians on both sides of the conflict say that regardless of who is in charge of Hamas, they just want the fighting to end. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
And in a related story, an Iranian state news site published video on Tuesday showing black-clad women of Iran's morality police assaulting a teenage girl who refused to wear a hijab on a Tehran street. The video of the June 21st incident went viral among Persian social media users inside and outside of Iran, with most people expressing outrage at how the police women dragged and pulled the 14-year-old girl across a street and into a waiting van as she tried to resist. Incidents of morality police brutality in Iran have been caught on camera and posted to social media multiple times this year. but the ones posting the videos have been activists and citizen journalists. What's unusual about the latest incident is that it was posted by Ensaf News, an Iranian state-approved news site, albeit a reformist-minded one. My colleague Michael Lippin sat down with Arash Sigarshi. He's senior managing editor for VOA's Persian service. He was asked how an Iranian state news site would be able to publish a video so embarrassing to Iran's Islamist rulers.
Anytime Islamic Republic wants to change their major concern, they use their state media to throw out the subject and watch the discussion and reactions, and then they announce, hey, we have a major policy change. So for this one, I can see 2 years after Mahsa Amini killed during the arrest by morality police, we see a significant video. Two girls, underage girls, were beaten by
teenagers.
Police. Exactly. And after that, a lot of reactions come from people who are, I can say, connected to the government, connected to the regime. Many reformists who 2 months ago asked people to vote.
To vote for Pezeshkian.
Pezeshkian, exactly.
Who won the presidency.
Yeah. Since Mahsa Amini was killed during the arrest, a lot of change happened in Iran. People were disappointed, and we saw 2 elections after that, and the turnout rate was so low. So now we see this video published by state media, and a lot of, again, reaction to requests, people who close to Pezeshkian to ask him, hey, do something, stop this morality police and stuff like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if after these reactions it comes, hey, we want to cancel that morality police.
So do you think the publication of this video by an Iranian state news site is a way for the reformists to try to push forward a reform that the more conservative people in the Iranian establishment don't want? And the Iranian establishment, the conservatives, definitely are very determined to keep enforcing the hijab through whatever means necessary.
Let me divide several discussions we have here. If people want something, they put on social media. They don't trust any media. And media, they don't want to publish anything from people, honestly. If it comes from reformists, it's not reformists versus conservatives. Because as a fact, we know, Mr. Pezeshkian, when he was a candidate, several times clearly says, I will follow Mr. Khamenei as a supreme leader. I will obey everything he says. So I don't see any, you know, Pezeshkian versus Khamenei, Pezeshkian against Khamenei. Even in this kind of issue, if comes, reformists first get green light from office of the supreme leader and then bring it to the public. So I don't see any conflict here. It looked like more, based on experience we had, a setup. Hey, we publish that. Let's put the pressure by public opinion. And then we say, hey, we are nice. We are canceling the morality police.
So why do you think that Khamenei and people around him would be willing to even consider reducing the toughness of their hijab enforcement?
The answer to your question is because he decided to Pezeshkian become new president. Mr. Pezeshkian was disqualified in 3 years ago election, presidential election. Why he was qualified is what he had done to become a qualified. He didn't do anything. Even he was pro-Mahsa movement. He several times gave a speech and talked about Mahsa Amini. So in the regime pattern, it should be disqualified this year too. But Khamenei decided he become a candidate. He qualified by the Guardian Council. And then he got a vote. Even he got some support from some conservatives who are very close to Mr. Khamenei. That shows me Khamenei was angry to Pezeshkian become a president because they want to show a new face in the world. Specifically when Khamenei was praying for Ismail Haniyeh body.
He was the Hamas leader who was assassinated in Tehran.
Exactly. And one of the videos we published on our website showed Khamenei asked very quietly and privately asked Pezeshkian to be his side That showed me he wants to show the world, hey, we have a surgeon, medical doctor, new president, new face. He's not mullah. He's modern, and he speaks several languages. So let's deal with that. So that's why I think Iranian regime tried to give a new wave to the world.
Arash Sigarshi, he's senior managing editor for VOA's Persian service. You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. In Venezuela, there's still a fervor over the recent contested election. President Nicolas Maduro appears to be shooting the messenger by lashing out at big tech and social media companies. Reuters' Ryan Chang has that story.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro issued a 10-day ban on social media platform X in the country on Thursday, saying it had been used to incite violence following the country's presidential election. This comes after the country's electoral authority proclaimed Maduro winner of the July 28th presidential election, although it has yet to produce tallies proving he'd won what they say was 51% of the vote. He earlier criticized platform owner Elon Musk on state TV.
Elon Musk is the owner of X and has violated all the rules of the social network Twitter itself, today known as X. He has violated the rules by inciting hatred, fascism, civil war, death, confrontation of Venezuelans, and has violated all Venezuelan laws.
Get up! Get up, Elon Musk! Get up!
The quarrel between Maduro and Musk has grown since the vote. Maduro blames the owner of X for being the driving force behind post-election protests and dissent, while Musk has compared the Venezuelan president to a donkey, and both of them have offered and accepted challenges to fight each other in comments on X and on Venezuelan state television. The ban is another big swipe at big tech from Maduro this week, after he urged supporters to ditch WhatsApp in favor of Telegram or WeChat. He claimed WhatsApp was being used to threaten the families of soldiers and police officers. Meanwhile, on Thursday, foreign ministers of Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia repeated their calls for Venezuela's electoral body to release polling records for last month's disputed election. The US, Argentina, and Chile have refused to recognize Maduro's claimed victory.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us. On Thursday's show, we spoke about Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz and his foreign policy as it relates to trade. Now a look at his unique relationship with China. His ties to China will likely inform his work if elected. Where does he stand on key issues and how does Beijing see him? Everyone, it seems, has an opinion. VOA's Anita Powell and Paris Huang report from Washington.
Tim Walz spent a year teaching in China in 1989 and later organized student trips, and says he has visited the country more than 30 times over the years. Republicans say Walz's long ties to China mean Beijing will welcome him joining the Harris ticket and predict he will loosen hardline U.S. economic and trade policies. J.D. Vance is a Republican vice presidential nominee.
She selected Tim Walz, a guy who wants to ship more manufacturing jobs to China.
Vance appeared to be referring to Walz's several years old support for trade with China as Minnesota's governor. Walz made no mention of China at his debut campaign appearance. But here is the then congressman in 2016 about how he viewed the country's relations with the United States.
I don't fall into the category that China necessarily needs to be an adversarial relationship. I totally disagree, and I think we need to stand firm on what they're doing in the South China Sea. But there's many areas of cooperation that we can work on.
And with VOA in 2014, he described what it was like to live there for a year following the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests.
And it was very powerful, and I'm certainly honored to have been there and to see the spirit of the Chinese people about trying to very proud of their country, but understanding that freedom needs to shine.
In China, in the hours after his debut on the campaign trail, Harris's vice presidential pick quickly became a trending topic. This user said, "I think he might be friendly to China." Other Chinese internet users thought he would take a harder line. While in Congress, Walz co-sponsored a number of resolutions critical of China's human rights record. One nationalist military historian said the Democrats want to destroy China. Others commented on what Walz called his life-changing lunch with the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled leader, with one user saying the former teacher in China looked like an American spy. Keen China watchers say that so far Beijing has not publicly reacted. But here's what they see in Walz. Kaiser Hua is host of the Seneca podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China.
He's been very forthright in his criticisms of China's human rights record. And I think he's done that from a position that is maybe more credible. It's because of his kind of conspicuous earnestness and his sincerity and the embodiment of the kind of, you know, values that he purports to be wanting to spread to China.
Other China analysts agreed that the Harris-Walz administration is expected to largely continue the toughen China policies of the Biden and Trump administrations. Jim Fallows covered China as a journalist, has written two books on the country, and was a speechwriter for former President Jimmy Carter.
I think this should be seen around the world, in China, in Asia, as continuity in the complex, decades-long U.S. policy of recognizing the need to deal with China as a major power in that the world and that part of the world, but also the differences in values, especially when it comes to democratization.
But what does Beijing think? That's harder to guess.
I would imagine they're essentially gobsmacked at the moment of not knowing what to make of this person who's not who they expected.
So as this duo, both born in 1964 under the same lunar zodiac sign, barnstorms America, Beijing can only wonder, what would the future hold with a pair of wood dragons in the White House? Anita Powell, Viewing News, Washington.
And finally, today, sub-Saharan Africa has been making strides towards gender equality, but a report by Gallup shows women still face discrimination despite commitments by most African countries to empower women and to reduce gender disparity. Juma Manjanga reports from the VOA Africa News Center in Nairobi.
The report, Gender Power in Africa, examined gender equality in Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda and Zimbabwe. It shows women still face discrimination. Julie Ray is the managing editor for World News at Gallup.
There are a number of factors at play, including social expectations that are placed on women in these countries, and those remain barriers to participation in education and the labor market.
Wanjiru Gikonyo, a governance expert in Nairobi, says the inequalities are rooted in social and cultural norms and traditions that can be traced to the colonial era. Wanjiru says most constitutions in Africa have provisions for gender equality, but adherence remains a challenge.
When it comes to power, we are very patrimonial. So we are still dealing with a lot of patrimonialism that is very undemocratic and allows a lot of undemocratic practices to continue and a lot of injustice to go unspoken.
Gallup's Ray says the imbalances act as barriers to social and economic development of women, which affects Africa's overall development.
Generally, access to education and participation in the labor market still remains limited if compared to men. But more women participating in the workforce, more jobs, is, of course, a bonus for economic growth.
The United Nations Development Programme ranks sub-Saharan Africa as the worst performing region in the Gender Inequality Index, a composite measure reflecting the disparity between women's and men's achievements in reproductive health, empowerment, and labor market. Experts say Africa has made progress toward gender equality, but much work remains to be done to ensure that women have equal economic opportunities and are free from discrimination. Juma Manjanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.